This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Welcome to Keeping the Faith. Our guest today is Cliff Kindy from Indiana, who is part of the Christian Peacemaker teams, and he's recently spent time in Iraq. Welcome, Cliff.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's
good to be here. When were you most recently in Iraq?
I've been in Iraq each of the last 3 years for 5 months each year, but most recently from early November last fall, about a year ago, until the end of March this spring.
Now, why in the world would you go?
I go because I guess I have a hope that what we do can begin to shape our future, that if we are serious enough about our peacemaking, we can do it at the same level and maybe even with the same risk that warriors do their war making. But I think peacemaking is more effective than war making in terms of achieving goals.
Now, we're recording this program in the middle of November because that's when you're here visiting the University of Illinois. And at this time, there have been over 2,000 Americans who've been killed in that war and maybe up to 100,000 Iraqis,
yes,
civilians and military personnel. Which of those numbers makes the most sense to you, having been there for so many months over the last 3 years?
I think both of those are tragedies. I think, unfortunately, at this point, the numbers that are 2,000 and growing are going to keep growing unless we change course. And the 100,000 or 150,000 or whatever Iraqi civilians that have died in this conflict since 2003 are going to keep increasing. I mean, our CPT team in Iraq right now is reporting that in the morgue in Baghdad, there are 30 to 50 new bodies every morning with a single gunshot to the head. And those don't include the people that die because of the suicide bombings, because of the bombings from U.S. forces on their communities or whatever.
But in terms of the estimates of Iraqi killed as a direct result from this war, what numbers make the most sense to you? Because they're as low as 35,000,
yeah,
as you say, up to over 100,000.
Well, I'm not an expert on that.
Okay.
I think the Johns Hopkins study that came out with that was published in the Lancet Journal of Medicine in Britain is probably fairly accurate. They tried to be conservative in that figure of 100,000. That was over a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
What those numbers might be, unfortunately, I think we'll never know. I think it is true that, as in most recent wars, 80 to 90% of the people who die in the war are civilians. I think that's fairly consistent.
And part of that's as a result of direct action, and part of it's a result of other things, right?
We call that collateral damage.
Right. And trying to be gentle.
Yes.
Mm. Now, how did you get involved in being on this steering committee for the Christian Peacemaker teams and being willing to go out into the field in places,
yeah,
like Iraq?
Well, I was asked by somebody from the Church of the Brethren. The Church of the Brethren was one of the three denominations, being Church of the Brethren, the Mennonite Church, and the Friends or Quakers, who were the people who started Christian Peacemaker teams, sort of the sponsoring bodies. At this point, we're probably 20-some, couple dozen different denominations involved in CPT. But I was asked to be on the steering committee. That got me involved. And then I usually blame our daughter Miriam, our younger daughter Miriam, for me being out in the field. It was back in 1993 when we were going to put a sort of a trial run in Gaza Strip. We had been asked to send a team. The director asked me to go. And despite all my objections, because of responsibilities for a family and because of the busyness of the summer, Miriam at one point said, "Daddy, lots of fathers and sons leave home in Gaza Strip and never come home. You're going to only be gone for 3 months. Maybe we should make it possible for you to go." So Daddy went.
How old was Miriam at that point?
Miriam was about 13.
Hmm. Do you have other children?
Our older daughter, Erin, who's been a full-timer with CPT in the last 3 years, working primarily in Chiapas, Mexico, and Colombia.
And she's how old?
Erin is 26 now.
And What did your spouse think of your doing this?
Well, Arlene's been a couple times with CPT to Haiti, and she was twice in Chiapas before I ever ended up there. And when I was coming out of Iraq during the hot war in 2003, she was in Colombia. So it's been kind of a family project.
And how does your family happen to be so fabulously wealthy that you can take this much time away from work to do this?
Well, that's a good question. We intentionally, when we were married 34 years ago, we made the decision to limit our income but keep it below the taxable level so we weren't paying taxes for the wars we were trying to stop. And that frees us up, gives us the time that we need. When the girls were growing up, we did lots of volunteer disaster work after hurricanes and tornadoes and floods. And now we're doing a lot of volunteer work in war zones around the world. And that seems to be a good way to put our lives together at this point.
Which of these religious traditions do you happen to come from that you mentioned?
I'm from the Church of the Brethren.
My
father was a pastor in the Church of the Brethren.
Now, that's a small denomination in this country.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about it. As the son of a pastor, I'm sure you've heard it many times.
The Church of the Brethren started in the period after the heavy wars in Central Europe. It started in Germany in 1708. Church of the Brethren, because of persecution, came to the United States. Was probably taken in by some of the communities that William Penn would have started around Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And it was a rural community, so the Church of the Brethren spread across North America to good farmland sites in Virginia and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Illinois, Kansas, on to California.
When did your family come to the Midwest?
Dad grew up in Naperville, Illinois, so he was a large family, a farming community in Naperville. And he would have been born around there. Arlene and I came to Indiana in 1971 when we were married.
Is Arlene's background Church of the Brethren as well?
Also, yes.
Mm-hmm. So this is a branch of the Protestant tradition that's, what would be fair to say, radical?
Probably.
Part of the radical Reformation?
In some ways, yes. It came out of the Anabaptist mm-hmm. and Pietist movements, mm-hmm. Central Europe. So it would have been influenced by both of those. Maybe the most radical thing about the Church of the Brethren is their attempt to hear what Jesus said, and especially the Sermon on the Mount, and say that this is how we should live. Loving enemy, overcoming evil with good. So,
and that's a bit surprising, isn't it, for Christians, whether Catholic or Protestant or Orthodox, because there seems to be much more emphasis on who Jesus is and sort of believing certain things about that rather than doing what Jesus said to do.
Well,
have you noticed that?
Yeah, the Brethren probably said that faith is something we live out. And so how do we live in such a way that it we could be convicted for being Christian if people saw us doing it.
Now, this decision that you and your spouse made back 35 years ago when you first got married to limit your income voluntarily, what did your respective families think about that? You were going to perhaps have children? What did your mother-in-law say?
Well, in some ways, my parents had, Dad had refused to accept the scale level of salary level of pastors in the Church of the Brethren. So we were influenced by Dad and Mom's decision that way. Arlene's folks probably thought it was a bit strange, but they were willing to go with their daughter's good judgment or what they thought was a good judgment. And they gave me a chance, and we've had good relationships.
Now tell our listeners practically how you do that. How do you live on such a what would seemingly be a substandard amount of money?
Well, for the first 15 years of our married life, we didn't have a car. we intentionally made choices trying to live a lifestyle that doesn't need to be defended by war. We talked about it in those ways. And so we tried to be pretty cautious about decisions of buying or using money. So we didn't use a lot of money. We raised our own food in the garden.
How did you get property?
When we had property, we bought the land with another family, also kept their income below the taxable level. And we started with a piece of property that was run down. The buildings were run down, and we put the sweat labor into fixing up those buildings. We now live in what used to be a drive-through corn crib, but it's a stone house with a standing seam roof, and it's one of the best insulated buildings in the county, probably.
And you live in what part of Indiana?
North Manchester, Indiana.
Where is that?
It's about 30 miles southwest of Fort Wayne. It's in the northeast quadrant of Indiana.
So living in a silo, raising your own food.
No, it used to be a drive-through corn crib.
Corn crib. I'm sorry. It's not a silo.
But it's a very nice, easy to care for, easy to heat. Room for recently we had 11 people staying overnight with us.
And the two families built this together?
We first lived in the farmhouse, and we had lived there about a year before Bob and Rachel moved there. And so we had fixed that up, and we were living there in the farmhouse together for a while as we were working on the corn crib building. So
now it's hard for two people to live together, married or not. Is it exponentially harder when there are four?
Oh, we had our rough times. We both had two children at that point, and so we learned to adjust to each other. On the farm, my parents have moved there since Dad retired, and another family is just moving into a yurt as we speak.
But Bob and Rachel are still there?
Yes.
So the four of you have lived together how long now?
Well, we've been there at what we call Joyfield Farm for about 22 years together, yes.
And how does it differ from what used to be called hippie communes?
Well, probably the seniority of my parents probably makes it look less hippie-ish, and and maybe our age now and the kinds of more traditional things that we do, like having a market garden. And
how did you earn a living when you first started to get money to even buy property?
Let's see. Some of those first years, I worked on a farm. It was a hog farm. I was a herdsman for a while. I did some substitute teaching. Arlene worked at Manchester College in food service for a while. I was a private contractor for doing construction work. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the things I did, mm-hmm. things that gave me the flexibility to do our disaster work and our peace work.
And I will get back to that, but let me just explore a little bit more your background. Since you were able to do substitute teaching, you have a college degree?
Yes.
From where?
I went to college in Manchester College and Goshen College, both in Indiana.
And those are related to religious groups?
One is a college within the tradition of the Church of the Brethren. The other one is a college within the tradition of the Mennonite Church.
So I think maybe I and our listeners have a picture of your lifestyle, your life choices. When did you make your first visit to a place where you would do this sort of long-term service?
Hmm. Well, maybe one of the first. I should go back. When I was born, my parents were in Brethren Volunteer Service. They were volunteers working in a migrant camp in Pahokee, Florida. I was named for Clifford Nakatagawa, who was a friend of theirs who was in the U.S. concentration camps because he was Japanese-American. I remember Dad was working with some civil rights issues, and I remember learning to read, learning about the story of the Montgomery bus boycott and Martin Luther King Jr. So maybe those kinds of things are part of the reason I am who I am. Mm-hmm. When I went into Brethren Volunteer Service, would have been during the Vietnam War as a conscientious objector initially. One of my first responses was working after Hurricane Camille on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. So we were living in a primarily African-American community at a time when that was pretty deep south.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump up to the present, which is, of course, why you were here on the 16th of November and talking at the Urbana Free Library about your experiences in Iraq over the last 3 years. When you first went to Iraq, what did you expect to see?
I went 5 months before shock and awe started in March of 2003. And because I've been in other war zones, I figured that even though it might be different from what others would expect, that I would meet human beings. And this was a time when to go into Iraq was breaking the sanctions, the U.S. sanctions, so it was $1 million fine and 12 years in prison, potentially. And maybe part of that's because it's hard to make enemies if we see another person and discover they're a human being. So going into Iraq, we were asking ourselves the question, what would it take to stop a war for a change? It looked like we were building toward it. What would it take to stop this war? And one of my first discoveries was something that confirmed that we shouldn't have a war, that, whoa, these are human beings over here in Iraq. They aren't all enemies. In fact, they welcome me. Even as a U.S. citizen, they made a clear distinction in those early months between U.S. policy and U.S. people. And that was pretty mind-blowing.
And what was the situation there, as far as you could tell, between various groups of Iraqis? Was there the same kind of hostilities that we've seen since the war?
No. Even up to a year and a half ago, as we would talk to Iraqis about the possibility of a civil war, they'd say, a civil war here in Iraq? We're married to each other across the lines of Shia and Sunni or Kurds. We live next door to each other. We work together. Yes, we are different. We have differences, but underneath it all, we're Iraqi. Now, at this point, that's more difficult to see in Iraq. There's much, you know, people might say, well, our presence is preventing a civil war. Well, I think we'll probably have a civil war on our hands right now. There are 50 bodies a day coming into the Morgan, Baghdad, with single gunshot wounds to the head.
And who is doing the killing?
It's hard to tell who. It's speculated that there are groups on both sides of that Sunni-Shia divide who are at least main actors in that atrocity.
But the majority might be getting back at the minority who had been in control under Saddam for the kind of violence that was going on during that regime?
Well, it's both Sunni and Shia bodies that are coming into the morgue, so it's
equal number?
I don't know. It's a pretty good balance
is
at
it?
This point, yeah.
Is that a concern of the Christian peacemaker teams? To try to
yes.
stop that kind of violence as well as U.S. presence
yeah.
there?
Yes. As we think about ending a war, I mean, as you talk about that, you have to think about what are the consequences for the people in Iraq. And one of the privileges we had this past year was to be part of the training of a Muslim peacemaker team. It was a Iraqi human rights group that had been working in Karbala, one of the Shia pilgrimage sites south of Baghdad. They had started in 2003 with the U.S. invasion. One of their first actions was the documentation of the mass graves from under Saddam Hussein's regime against the Shia population, especially in the south. Their presence has been a powerful witness to us because of the ways in which they've built bridges between those different groups within Iraq at a time when most people are building barriers.
Mm-hmm.
It's an inspiring group to work with. And so we see their work as very essential to go along with what our work is to try to stop a war in Iraq.
How did the Muslim peacemaking team get started? Did you recruit people? Did you talk to imams?
This human rights group is the group that put the whole operation together. They had been working as a human rights group, and they were the people that kept Karbala together as the one army was retreating and the other army coming through in 2003. They trained themselves to defuse unexploded ordnance. They were the ones who cared for the widows, that made sure people got medical care, made sure the political structure kept operating even after everybody had been removed as the U.S. Army came through, U.S. military came through. Mm. So they had even been asked at one point by the U.S. representatives there if they would serve as the mayor or the governor of that whole region. They had done such a good job. They refused because they said they wouldn't be able to do the job if they were seen as working with the U.S. forces.
By the time this program is aired in December of 2005, there will have probably been some changes from this time when we're recording it on the 16th of November. But this week, the U.S. Congress has voted, even with a Republican majority, to push the administration under President Bush to come up with a way for American presence to get out of Iraq. Mm-hmm. Can you see that happening soon?
Yes. I think it's clear at this point that Iraqi security forces will not be able to pick up the role that the United States military wants them to pick up, either cannot or will not do that. The resistance in Iraq is growing dramatically. The resistance within the U.S. military is growing quickly. I think we don't have many options. I think the best option at this point is to pull back from the urban areas, to hire Iraqis to do their own rebuilding of the infrastructure. Those are things we should have done years ago, and stop provocative things like the flyovers of residential areas by helicopter gunships and fighter jets and the attacks on population centers that like is happening in the western region of Iraq. That only increases the recruitment levels for the resistance. We can't, quote, win as we see it. I think we can win in ways in terms of recovering our image around the world, in terms of saving the lives of Iraqis and U.S. soldiers.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith today with Cliff Kindy, who represents the Church of the Brethren on the steering committee for the Christian Peacemaker teams that include, I think you said, about 20 different denominations.
Yes.
At this point, who send people to war zones and disaster zones and try to work for justice and peace. We'll be getting back to him in just a moment, but let me remind listeners that ordinarily we do invite phone calls for these Keeping the Faith programs on Sundays here at AM 580 WILL. But because this program we needed to pre-record when we had a chance to visit with our guest, that we will not be accepting telephone calls today. Cliff, when you were talking about your experience in Iraq and saying what it might take for U.S. presence to come to an end there, you said you really think it's possible, and you mentioned some things that it would take. Why aren't we doing those things?
Well, I think Iraq is strategic at this point in terms of a global picture for the United States hegemony around the world. With the Caspian Sea resource-rich region to the northeast, the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia to the south, the significance of the European Union to the northwest and Egypt and Israel to the west, you couldn't choose at these times a better place to be. We aren't going to get Iran, so Iraq looks to be our choice. So we aren't anxious to pull out in one sense. we are anxious to pull out in another sense. And so I think it's a pretty complex situation. We have a mix of political interests involved, as if we speak as a U.S. administration at this point. We're there. One of the things that I think we haven't been very astute about is trying to understand the different players in that drama of the war in Iraq. There are foreign fighters, groups like probably from Iran and Syria. And they're clear that as long as there's a conflict in Iraq, there won't be, there's less likely to be attacks on their own countries. Secondly, one of the major actors is Al-Qaeda or groups like that who nowhere else in the world can get 60 to 100 hits a day against the U.S. empire.
Sure.
And they'll be there as long as we're there. But the majority of the resistance within Iraq at this point is homegrown people who are upset because their country's occupied. Somebody else is making the decisions that impact their future. That's going to be something that's going to continue to grow. And it's that piece that, as we work in Iraq, seems clearer and clearer. We were there right after the war. And at that point, Iraqis were willing to give us some space. I mean, they had heard the stories that the U.S. would be rebuilding right on the heels of the invasion. They thought, well, great, this could really turn around because it is a very rich country. It has a wealth of educated people and resources. It had one of the best healthcare systems in the whole Middle East, one of the best educational systems in the whole Middle East. That's been destroyed by the wars and the sanctions and now the occupation. So they were willing to be patient. Now we're, what, 2.5 years later, and Iraqis are upset because they only see it going downhill.
Mm-hmm.
Worse and worse. I mean, the infrastructure is far worse than it was before the war, when we were there, even during the war. The access to electricity, to good water, to jobs, to security. I mean, all those issues are total disasters in Iraq at this point. So Iraqis are giving up on the hope they did have with a change. Most of them were excited that Saddam was gone. They may not have approved of the way in which it happened, but they saw this as a space for a different future. And now they don't no longer have that kind of hope.
Since we're not able to invite listeners to ask questions during this program, let me try to imagine what a listener might ask who disagrees with your
good
perspective.
Good, very good.
What wasn't the situation in Iraq under Saddam so bad that an intervention was absolutely necessary?
Let me first respond. I want to be clear that I bring a perspective on the situation in Iraq. And so I think it's important for listeners to also hear the stories of soldiers coming home, contractors coming back, different media perspectives. So our experience in Iraq, as we worked very closely with many Iraqi families several years ago, as we worked with detainees, Iraqis who had been detained by the U.S. military. And some of the stories they would tell us, one, they said when Saddam came and wanted to arrest somebody, he came in the daytime, not at night like the U.S. soldiers come. He came in the daytime and he had a name. He had the names of people he wanted. He said, I want this person, this person, this person, knocked on the door and said, this is who we want. And he took those people, but nobody else. When the U.S. comes, like in the village of Abu Sifa village, they took every single male in the village, mm-hmm. from teenagers to a 90-year-old visitor in the community. And when that happens consistently, people begin to say, wait a minute, what's going on? I mean, why don't you? And at this point, the International Red Cross is saying that 70 to 90% of the people who were in U.S. prisons in Iraq were there without any charges. And so people begin to feel used or abused. Another comment that we have from Iraqis, they said, we had hope for something better to happen. But what we're discovering is that what we have under Bush is what we have had under Saddam. Saddam and Bush are brothers. That's the comment they make. But again,
to follow up, as maybe our listener would ask, weren't there a lot more people killed, gassed, imprisoned, tortured under Saddam than currently?
Well, we hear, in the South, we're uncovering the mass graves, a couple dozen, maybe 5,000 in Hilla. We hear about the village in the north that was probably gassed by Saddam, maybe 5,000 or 6,000 people there. And then we look at the numbers that come out of the study from Johns Hopkins University, and it's 100,000 a year ago. Well, those numbers don't make a whole lot of difference. It's not like one's dramatically better than the other. They're both horrible. Neither one should have happened. Neither one should be going on. And so I don't want to say, oh, this is so much better, we need to keep it going. Or I don't want to say, no, Saddam was so much better, we need to return it. No, we don't want either of those to happen. We want Iraq to have a place where people can live in security with jobs as human beings.
Since you've had the opportunity, since you've taken the opportunity, taken the risk to be in Iraq for these long periods of time over the last 3 years, you've had a chance, I'm sure, to get to know specific people in Iraq. Could you tell us about some of those, what some of their stories have been?
One of the people we worked with the Muslim Peacemaker Team, is a high school teacher. His wife died of cancer in the early 80s. He remarried and then had children. And he's a very interesting person. His name is Hussein Ali Brahimi. He was, even though he's a full-time teacher, he always finds time to do other things. So he was active in training the election observers during the election a year ago in Iraq. He was, for a while, the president of the Muslim Peacemaker, or I guess he is now, the Muslim Peacemaker team that we helped to train in Karbala. He's willing to take risks. He's a heavier set, a bigger man, but very always looking on the bright side of things, making jokes when he comes to stay with us. He's just fun to be with. He's an amazing person. When we were doing the training, we recognized that to train peacemakers, you have to deal with pretty traumatic situations sometimes, and you have to look at and understand your own trauma. So one day, I remember the coordinator, facilitator for that day, had a pink paper heart, and she held that up in front of the group that was training, and she said, "Invite everybody to come up and tear out a piece of the heart and tell the stories of the trauma or the pain that's part of their life." And Assad said, "You don't have time to hear our stories. We've lived through three wars and the sanctions and now the occupation. You don't have time. All the books on the wall would be more than filled up with our stories of pain." But then when he did start, he said, "I was in the war in the north. I was fighting the trenches against Iran, Iraq. And one night I slept in the trenches with a dead body on either side of me. Another time, my best friend was killed by a sniper, by an Iranian sniper, and I had to carry his body out on my shoulder." And then he told the story during the U.S. invasion in 2003. His friend had trained himself to defuse unexploded ordnance, and he'd gotten a call about supper time and that there was a anti-personnel weapon that was over in a schoolyard, and children were coming the next day. So he asked his friend who was trained to do that if he could go, and he said yes. And so the two of them went over, and when his friend looked at that anti-personnel weapon, he said, "Oh, the wires are really messed up. Please, everybody stand back." And he was killed then as he tried to defuse the weapon. So Assad has that kind of story that comes from both Saddam's regime and the U.S. invasion and just the kind of trauma that if you talk to Iraqis, almost every family has that kind of traumatic story, and you begin to wonder how people can even continue to exist with that kind of pain.
And when you're that close to that kind of pain, to real people with that kind of pain, How do you get your strength to keep doing what you're doing? You're separated from your family. You're in a risky place where your own life's at risk. Do you get support from the other people on the team?
Yeah. Our team life is essential to our work. We have a daily time of worship together. We've recognized in CPT in recent years the kind of danger that trauma brings to our work.
Christian Peacemaker Team. I'll repeat for listeners who may have just tuned in.
Sorry. And so we've recognized that we have to have a kind of routine, a discipline that keeps us psychologically, spiritually, physically healthy. But even then, it isn't a cure-all. I've recognized this year in ways I never have before in my work with Christian Peacemaker Teams that I bring the war situations home. When I come home, often telling the story is a part of my healing. Often working in our garden is a part of my healing. I call the garden my healing place. But this year, in ways I've never recognized before, I realize the war hangs on in my life. And so I'm asking myself the question, is this kind of work sustainable? Is Christian Peacemaker teamwork sustainable? And if it is, what do we have to do to maintain that? Because I am carrying it in ways.
How many are on your team?
Usually in Iraq, we've had anywhere, depending on whether the delegation is there, we've had anywhere from 3 to a couple dozen people.
And this last time?
Most of the time I was there, we were a team of 4 to 5 people.
Where do you live?
We live in an apartment in central Baghdad, right along the Tigris River. It's a beautiful place in many ways. I can see the flocks of birds moving in migration along that river. In the summer, it's a very hot place.
Has your wife been there with you?
Arlene has not been with me in Iraq. We've decided to go separately so that if something happens, that our daughters still have one parent.
Sure. Now, why Christian Peacemaker Teams? Why wouldn't you welcome someone from another religion or an atheist or agnostic?
Very good question. By calling ourselves Christian Peacemaker Teams, we recognize that that's the inspiration for our work. That's what undergirds our peacemaking. That's the spirituality that undergirds us. We work very closely with traditional religions, with Jewish peacemakers, with Muslim peacemakers, with others in other traditions, but that's the tradition out of which we come. And as we worship together, we at a minimum ask that those who share with us, who meet with us, at least accept that framework for our work together. We're encouraging both Jewish peacemaker teams and Muslim peacemaker teams. We've worked closely with in indigenous communities in Mexico with more traditionalists, and we've encouraged peacemaker teams and that we can work together with.
And what do you actually do on the ground in Iraq?
Very good question. One of the things we did was issued a report about detainees. We met with some of the highest-ranking U.S. political figures and military figures 4 months before the Abu Ghraib expose happened. We said things have to change. I mean, these are the kinds of reports we're getting. And it wasn't just Abu Ghraib. It was all across the board.
So you had heard of torture?
Oh, yes. We had, at that point, we had published a report that included 70 different individuals, families, and individual detainee stories.
Is that available online?
I think that's probably still available online at cpt.org. You could check the link to Iraq and Iraqi detainees. If not, you could contact the CPT office in Chicago. Go check that website.
cpt.org.
Yes, okay. And that'll give you the phone number or address in Chicago or Toronto, where our two offices are. But those kinds of things are things we did in Iraq. I mean, one of the big things we do is cross the barriers that get built between people, whether it's religious groups, whether it's political groups or ethnic groups. We try to cross those barriers, hear the stories on each side, try to help to build bridges between those groups. Right now, we're looking at the whole issue of of torture. I mean, for the last couple months, we've been trying to document the stories that are coming out from Iraqi families about torture that's happening, this time from Iraqi by Iraqi security. The thing that just broke this last couple of days about there was a U.S. military group that raided one of the Ministry of the Interior prisons in Baghdad or near Baghdad.
That was back in mid-November, yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yes. And so we've been working with some of that. Another thing we tried to do is encourage local peacemakers and human rights groups. Mm-hmm. I mean, our work, the work that we can do is very small. It'll be the people in Iraq who do the big work that needs to be done. So if there are ways that we can nurture and encourage their efforts, encourage them, help them recognize that they're part of a bigger movement all around the world, that they aren't alone, that they are doing good work, that's what needs to happen, because they'll be the ones that make the changes in the country of Iraq. We're trying to tell the story. Often in a conflict zone, things continue to go badly, or injustice continues to happen, or violence continues to go on because people don't know the truth of what's happening. So sometimes just telling the story is one of the most important things we do. Our links back with our communities in North America, or we have CPTers from Britain or Australia or Latin America, other places around the world, so back to our communities.
And so that's one of the things that you do when you return to the U.S. is tell these kind of stories, and that's one of the reasons you were here in Champaign-Urbana.
Yes.
Back in November when we recorded this.
Yes.
I want to ask a little bit about, you said you got rejuvenated in your garden. Tell me about your garden.
We have an organic market garden, about 2.5 acres. As I talk about the healing that takes place in our garden, one of the things is when we plant a seed, when I come back from the war zone and plant a seed and watch it grow and develop, it renews my hope in life. A second thing is that the physical work of the garden helps me to slough off some of the unwanted baggage that I bring back from the war zone. And a third thing I usually talk about is that doing the routine things in the garden, like pulling weeds or mulching, you know, pushing the wheelbarrow to mulch between the rows or building the compost piles, are ways that I rebuild or re-nurture my creativity. And creativity is an essential ingredient to peacemaking work in war zones. So those are ways I usually point to as the healing aspects of our garden.
And this is a garden you sell produce from in a farmer's market, or how?
Yeah, there's a weekly farmer's market in North Manchester. We sell there, and we also sell about half at the market and about a third at our house.
So do you try to be in Iraq during the Indiana winter?
Yes, mm-hmm. That's how. And so I try to be home to help Arlene with the heavy, busy part of planting and the heavy harvest.
Will you be going back?
Well, at this point, this spring, we talked about what we have to do to end the tragedy of what's happening in Iraq. And as a team, we're making some long-term plans. And we said, yes, it's very important for us to be here, but we also need to have a team on the ground in the United States, because that's where lots of changes need to take place. So right now, my focus is on that. How do we put together a nonviolent campaign to end the war in Iraq?
Now, how are the activities of the Christian peacemaking team paid for? You're obviously donating your time away from your work, but how do you get money to eat and
travel?
We have
contributions from individuals and churches, mm-hmm. usually who have some connection with one of the people who work on one of the projects of Christian peacemaker teams.
How big of a budget does Christian peacemaker teams have?
We have a budget that runs about $1 million right now. We have
A million a year.
We have about 50 full-timers who are out in the field and about 150 reservists who work in the field. A staff who also spends a significant amount of time out in the field of probably a dozen.
Now, let's see, $1 million a year sounds like a lot. Is that less than the U.S. is spending on the war?
We figure it's about $14,000 per person per year.
On the war.
So that's significantly less than what it costs to put one soldier on the ground in Iraq.
Uh-huh. We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Cliff Kindy, that's K-I-N-D-Y, who is a member of the Church of the Brethren, a Protestant Christian denomination, and on the steering committee for the Christian Peacemaker Teams. He's recently come back from his third time in Iraq, spending 3 months.
Five months each time,
three different times. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. And because this program is pre-recorded and we're not exactly sure which date it will appear on, I will not be announcing to listeners who's coming up on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead. And let me remind you again, please do not try to call the station during this program, since we have needed to pre-record it in order to have this conversation with this particular guest that we were so delighted to have. But we will be getting back to the more traditional format next week from 5 to 6 here on AM 580 WILL. Incidentally, if you missed part of this interview and would like to hear it in its entirety, by the time you hear it, it will probably already be on the archives of Keeping the Faith on AM 580. You can go on your computer to WILL.UIUC.edu and then click on Keeping the Faith, and you'll see our various guests and the dates their interviews were aired, and you can listen to them anytime you like. Getting back to our guest, we were just talking about the funding for Christian peacemaking teams. How is it organized? Did you get elected to this board? Are all of you volunteers? You mentioned staff. There are some people who are paid salaries.
Yeah, and most of, like, our co-directors presently are at a salary level that most, quote, CEOs wouldn't touch. But because they work out this out of their commitment to peacemaking, we usually say salary is need-based. Uh-huh. You know, what do you need to care for your living expenses? What do you have that needs to go in to take care of you?
Now, you're in a family with a wife and a daughter still in the home, one daughter out of the home. But how much money do you get by on in a year?
Well, I told you we limit our income. We make about $6,000 to $8,000 a year from the garden, and I get paid a stipend of about $1,200 a year from Christian Peacemaker Teams.
And that's your total income for a year?
Yes. But as our daughter said, you know, we are very, very rich. We probably eat better than anybody else in the world. We have friends all around the world. We have a wonderful home to live in. We have a place that's a wonderful place to grow up. And so they always think that they're among the richest in the world.
Is your daughter in public school?
We homeschooled our daughters.
You homeschool your daughters?
Well, both of them are through school and are now away from home.
So. I see, both are. Okay.
Yes.
And did they go to college?
Our older daughter went for a while, but decided, well, I used to do this by myself. Maybe I don't need to pay somebody else to teach me.
Mm-hmm. So she found other ways to learn. And your younger daughter?
She's teaching in the equivalent of a one-room schoolhouse in a private religious school in Michigan.
I see. When you and your spouse chose this lifestyle, did you imagine you'd be going into war zones?
Hmm. Well, shortly after we were married, we were in Guatemala after the big earthquake there, and at that point it was beginning to be a war zone. And then later I went with Witness for Peace to Nicaragua when it was a war zone, there was a war going on. And some of the places that we did our disaster work in the United States before I became part of CPT were conflict zones.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you first went to Iraq, you said it was under the sanctions that had been imposed. It was before this most recent war broke out. Has life changed significantly for a typical Iraqi family from that time pre-war to now? Is it better or worse?
Let me just mention some things.
There was the sanctions made it pretty painful.
Yes, it was a very difficult time. The UN said maybe 500,000 children died during the sanctions just because of the damage to the water infrastructure. But when I was there in the months preceding the 2003 invasion, we had water almost all the time. This winter, when I was in Baghdad, at one point, there were 10 days when we had no public water in the whole city of Baghdad. This is a city of 5 million people, bigger than metropolitan Chicago, and no public water. The team writes that maybe there are 3 to 4 hours of electricity a day. Probably the most serious thing is security. Before the 2003 war, women could walk to university classes without any problem, no fear. And now it's rare that you find a woman walking alone on the street any time of day, just because there are more assaults against that would have never happened before. The mood toward women as a whole is changing pretty dramatically now. Women who would have been some of the professionals, the doctors, the professors, the engineers, that's more difficult for women now than it would have been before the war. Security in terms of children going to school. There are children who are kidnapped. There are, at one point, I heard reports of several kidnappings a week happening of families. Children or business people, people who might have money. And that just makes everybody in Iraq feel insecure. The possibilities that there would be raids on their houses. There, as I spoke earlier, there may have been raids by Saddam who came to get individuals, but not to attack whole houses. That would have been less a familiar event for Iraqis than it is today.
And what's the healthcare situation?
We hear the stories from hospitals that we visit that they're unable to get even regularly used medicines or tools that would be important for their medical care. And this is in a country where which would have had one of the best healthcare systems in the Middle East. So the healthcare system is not improving as we might have hoped.
What about education?
I think it's holding its own but not improving.
And what about the practice of religion, at least Islam?
Well, let me compare it with Christianity. Under Saddam, there were political figures who were Christian. But with the U.S. invasion, there's much more negative reaction to groups that are Christians, whether it's outsiders or Christians within Iraq itself. There are about 3%, 3 to 4% of the population in Iraq is Christian. Chaldean, Latin Catholic. There's a group we visited up in Mosul that still speaks the same language that Jesus spoke. But they are playing a less visible role in Iraq right now because the Christianity that Iraqis see is a missile coming from a fighter jet or a shell from an Abrams tank. And that's...
Are there Jews in Iraq?
There are a few, but very few. Mm-hmm. And very low visibility.
Mm-hmm. Is democracy possible there?
It won't be a democracy like we envision. I think there is a political process that can allow Iraqis to participate in shaping their future. But I think our presence, if it continues, is going to make that less likely. If our presence as a U.S. military occupation is going to make that less likely.
You mentioned the situation for women in Iraq. Is it possible for Westerners, for Americans, to meet and talk with women there?
We do regularly. As we bring delegations over for 2 weeks at a time, they would regularly meet with Iraqi families.
Are there women on your team?
There are women on our team.
Is it easier for them to talk with women?
It's easier for them than it would be for me, yes. Sure. Often if our team would go into an Iraqi home, we would be segregated by gender. Mm-hmm. So we would meet, although the women on our team are like a third gender. They can meet with both the men and the women, which wouldn't be as likely in other settings.
What about children? Can you talk with children?
Yes. Often, the park across our street is where the children gather every day to play soccer after school's out. or the young. There's a family that's homeless that lives in an abandoned shop, and they're often by knocking on our windows asking for water for us to come and talk with them. And so, and the children are the ones who learn English more quickly. Adults may have had English because they were in school earlier. It's the teenagers who are less likely because that was one of the things that was dropped during the sanctions.
Cliff, you mentioned earlier in the program that one of the things that was in your training from your father as a pastor or from your growing up and being educated in the Christian faith was a desire to follow the teachings of Jesus, particularly in the Sermon on the Mount about peace and turning the other cheek and the Beatitudes and so on. When this program is aired, it will be either during Advent or the Christmas season, when people in America are being reminded of the birth of Jesus, what would you like listeners to remember in relation to Iraq?
Well, if Jesus was born in an occupied territory, and maybe if we talk about Jesus coming back or we talk about meeting Jesus in the guise of the least of these, maybe we need to recognize that it might be Iraqis. Jesus might be coming to us as an Iraqi today. So how do we build that relationship with Jesus in today's society, in today's political situation?
And did you meet any times in your visits to Iraq, people that reminded you of Jesus, Iraqis?
Yes. I'm alive today because of a medical doctor in Rutba, Western Iraq, who sewed my head back together after it was split open in a car accident. I'm alive today because of that Iraqi for whom I would have been the enemy.
We've been talking today with our guest, Cliff Kindy, from the Christian Peacemaking Teams. If you would like to find out more about that, you may go to cpt.org on your computer. Christian Peacemaking Teams. Cliff is on the steering committee there. He comes from a Church of the Brethren background, lives in Indiana, and he and his spouse and family have been living at a subsistence level for 35 years or so as not to, through their taxes, contribute to war making. I want to thank Cliff for being our guest, and next week we'll be back on Keeping the Faith talking with our other guests, and we'll be offering you as listeners a chance to tune in. Thank you for being here, Cliff, and thank you. Thanks to our listeners for being part of this.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Every time a bell rings, an angel gets its wings. At this time of year, you're likely to hear that line over and over again as Jimmy Stewart plows through It's a Wonderful Life. But he's not the only one who's seen an angel, in or out of the movies. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on the Peabody Award-winning program To the Best of Our Knowledge, Angel Stories of All Kinds. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. Next time on PRI's The World, a family in Brazil discovered and embraced its Jewish roots. Now the Bezerras have moved to New Hampshire. They've brought their experience and their music to the Jewish community there. As Hanukkah begins, we hear Jewish music from Brazil. That and the day's news next time on The World, Monday at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. here on AM 580.